The animals, the animals, trap, trap, trap till the cages fall. The cages fall, the day is new, and everyone is waiting, waiting on you.
A podcast that takes on a variety of topics from pop culture to everyday life. I'm Chantel C. You can call me CC, and I'm joined by my partner in organizing, Denise.
Hello.
Hi, Denise. How are you?
I'd be good. How are you?
I'm well. I went to see Angels in America last night, the first part. I don't know if you're familiar with that play, but it's set in Reagan America, and it's about the lesions that certain men found appearing on their skin. And okay. It's a very interesting play. It's 7 hours long. I've only
Hello,
seen...
Hello, no. Hello, stop. Okay.
It's 7 hours long. I only saw part one last night. 3 hours. 3 hours. And while I was really enjoying it, I was really bothered and I couldn't figure it out until, like, it was there, but I couldn't really articulate it until this morning. The crazy people were women, and the comic relief slash caretaker slash magical was a black man.
Of course. What else could he actually be?
Like, and he's definitely black, like written into the play as black, because there's some moments that come up.
I see it.
And I was like, oh. I mean, I don't
know. Did you roll your eyes a little bit harder? Rashawn, we're going to need you to snap when you say that. Rashawn, I'm going to need, just a sec. I don't know. Rashawn, could you, more attitude, like just, you know, more urban. Rashawn.
That's kind of, especially, you know, always watching these things with certain audiences. It just doesn't sit right. Anyway, speaking of watching things with certain audiences, and this is kind of why I brought it up, because I felt like in the play, you could see it as something really intelligent, as showing us something that happens in real life. Or you could see it as just replicating and not showing us anything and not actually criticizing anything. And it's very hard for me to differentiate between the two. And today is June 9th. For those of you who don't know, our podcasts come out on Fridays. Today is June 9th. Netflix has been bombarding me on Instagram. And every time I go to my email, and every time I actually just go on Netflix, June 9th, we're almost there. June 9th, today, Orange is the New Black, new season will be released. And yes, just let me tell you, it's been a year. So if you haven't watched last season, I'm going to give you all the spoilers. So you might as well just move on to the second segment at this point. Okay. It's been a whole year. So you can't be mad at me about the spoilers that I'm about to give y'all. So I'm still, I don't know if I'm ready to watch the new season. I'm pretty sure I am going to watch it, which maybe makes me less radical than I should be. I don't know. I do watch Orange is the New Black regularly. I've watched all the seasons. And last year I took my time watching season 4. And I feel like we need to unpack a few things, talk about a few things before, you know, in preparation for season 5. Now, you don't watch it, so this is great.
Is it great?
Yes, because you can help me distill what is important. So Orange is the New Black, for those of you who may not know, it takes place in a women's prison. And you know, it takes on a lot of the different things that we know to be true in prisons, right? So there are different races and ethnicities that group together. You have different people experiencing different things. There have been rapes. There have been girlfriends. There have been murders, all within this prison. The show is technically a comedy. That is the category that it gets placed in for most award shows. Last season was especially dark. The previous season, season 3, went darker than season 2. But season 4 felt very dark because it took on things that we were experiencing and have been experiencing for years now. Basically, some people have called it a Black Lives Matter season. I wouldn't completely agree with that. There were a lot of themes that took place throughout the season. But the cliffhanger at the end of the season was one of our favorite characters, Pusey, who's played by Samira Wiley, was killed. So the entire season, they've shown us what happens when a prison gets privatized. There are cuts. They only care about making money and so on and so forth. They're showing us how prison labor gets used. And there is a man who turns out to be an abuser, but not an abuser of women. He's a homosexual who had to be moved from the male prison. He gets moved to the women's prison to bring in some order because the prison is kind of lax and, you know, the women are maybe doing the most and getting over on incompetent guards who were in a union and lost their jobs because of it. So this guy comes in, he runs a tight ship, and he allows a lot of horrible things to happen. The new guards who come in, they're just not good people. One has an abusive relationship with one of the inmates. He rapes her. A lot of things happening, like I said. And in the end, there's kind of a disruptive scene, and it reminds you of the scene of Eric Garner, because they want you to see it as an accident. Poussey is very small, she's very lightweight, and she gets held down in the moment of this uprising. And my question is it necessary to repeat, you know, the violence that we're experiencing every day in pop culture in this way?
Not for me. I think that there is a trafficking in Black bodies that I see in real life that I just don't really want replicated in my entertainment. That just doesn't, I don't even do the autoplay on videos anymore, because especially Sean King will show you a Black body being brutalized every day, you know.
But he will give you a trigger warning.
Will he?
Yes, he does do trigger warnings, but yes, he will still show you every video that exists.
Exactly. And it's a lot. And I can't really deal with it all the time. I definitely don't want to deal with it in my entertainment. I definitely don't want to deal with it in my, like, with my pretend wife in prison. Right? Like, I'm not interested. And you're right. I didn't see it. But from what I've read and what I understand, they do a lot of work to humanize this guard. Like, poor him, right? Because he was just trying to do his job, and he's really a nice person, and he doesn't have a racist bone in his body and all that bullshit. And then when you look at the writer's room, you see why they would take all this time to humanize this guard, why they wouldn't look at unconscious bias and how that works. Why, you know, when white people are depicted as doing really heinous, evil things to uphold white supremacy and sort of like brutalizing Black bodies, that there's all this attention being paid to their individual goodness. It's because as Son of Baldwin, is it Stacey or Son of Baldwin? One of them says, whiteness will always acquit itself. That is a central sort of thing that whiteness does. So you have all these white people in this writer's room, and, you know, they essentially acquit this man, at least morally, in their depiction of him, of this death.
I semi-agree with that statement. I think it's actually, and this is, don't kill me for it, but I think in this particular statement, it should be called power and not whiteness. Sometimes they can be equivalent and sometimes not. The Huffington Post had a great article talking about the Comey hearings happening right now and why the questions that were being asked probably ring familiar or true to a lot of women who have been survivors.
Mm-hmm. Victim blaming.
Yeah. And so I think, and in that article, they basically say power upholds power, and power will basically say, well, how did you get here? How did you let this happen to you? And mm-hmm. I think, you know, the whiteness acquits whiteness, I think that is coming from the same vein. I think my issue, though, is specifically with Orange is the New Black, is the fact that if you look at last season, and again, a lot of spoilers about to happen, there's a Black woman prison guard who brings in drugs. And what is her payment for that? Sex. You have to go down on her to get your drugs. The Black people who are in happy relationships are all in interracial relationships.
Mm-hmm.
None of the other Black women are in any type of relationship. And none of their stories, other than Poussey's, is normalized in any way. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. always quite extreme. Whereas some of the, I mean, everyone, there are a lot of people who have quite extreme stories that is not limited to the Black women, but it seems that none of the Black women have just like a story, other than what we were finally learning.
That
about
level
Poussey.
Of relatability, that level right. of like, it could be me.
Right.
You know, and who knows?
And like Poussey's story even, right? She speaks several languages. Her father is like a war veteran. She lived all over the world. So even her story is like, okay, the only reason that she speaks languages and has lived around the world is because she's like an army brat. And then she was kind of naive because she was an army brat and wound up in jail, which we still don't quite know how it happened, but we kind of have an idea of what happened before she came to jail. So it just feels like the Black characters specifically, I mean, the Latina women don't get a much better at, but the Black women specifically don't have much happiness.
Mm.
They aren't, you know, in happy relationships, at least not among each other. There's Poussey was in a relationship that was semi-happy, but she was being abused emotionally by someone who was racist, who didn't understand her racism, and that woman was an Asian woman. I don't know. There's just like a lot of things where I just have to ask, are you replicating with like a societal, social critique? Are you just replicating because you don't know any better, because you don't see it any differently?
I think they put a lot of effort into trying to make it realistic. I mean, the reality is it would be extremely hard to have a sustainable, happy relationship in such a toxic environment. It's already hard to have a sustainable, happy relationship outside of prison. Like, you can imagine how in.
But right? They have happy relationships on the show.
Right. Exactly. It's
and prison is not the original premise
of Orange is the New Black is centers on, is it Piper, a white woman, right?
Well, it's from her book, right? So
from her book, and so all of the relatable, normalized, most character developed stuff is going to happen with her and her crew. This show does a lot of work to build depth to side characters that might even just be passing through. Like, they do flashbacks, they like try to really round out these characters, but it's not about us.
No, I don't think so.
It's not about us. So we are just supporting character. We are comic relief. And sometimes
supporting characters who win all the awards though.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes depth is given, but not I don't see anyone in that writer's room that could fully understand the power of representation or why it would be important to have some level of Black joy on that show.
If you leave it to people to understand things that they aren't directly impacted by, that could be difficult. In the case of white people not wanting to hear the word, you know, no, which is what we have again, yet again. I don't know how many times we've talked about it on this show, but in this week's White People Can't Handle Being Told No news, Bill Maher felt the need to make a joke. And it was a really bad joke. Like, I don't even, like, you can, he even had a moment where he paused to think about, am I really going to say this? And he still chose to say it. He has a show called, what is it called?
Real Time with Bill Maher.
Thank you. Real Time with Bill Maher. And on the show, he was speaking with a senator from Nebraska. And basically, he was talking about, you know, things, politics, because that's what he likes to talk about. It seemed to have been like an amicable conversation. And eventually, the interview turns weird because I would say, you know, filler of small talk. Bill says, you know, quote, I've got to get to Nebraska more. And the senator says, you are welcome. We love to have you work in the fields with us, because Nebraska, you know, it's one of those states with a lot of fields. A lot of Bill counters and says, work in the fields? Senator, I'm a house nigger. And then he immediately added, it's a joke.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What is funny, which is what you imply when you use the word joke, about the enslavement of Black people systematically and the abuse of Black people and the oppression and separation of Black people over centuries.
Mm.
Some people were like, don't take it so hard. You know, he probably didn't mean it that way. Some people even said, I bet, you know, some of his close allies like Killer Mike, who, you know, is considered to be very woke, will come to his defense. Killer Mike didn't come to his defense, but he also didn't directly criticize it. Killer Mike, for example, said, I feel like, you know, people make mistakes. I know what's in his heart, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what's in his heart, but I do know what comes out of his mouth. And it's not the first time that he's made statements like this. In 2001, he had a show called Politically Incorrect. And on the show, from a clip from August 2001, he had like a group of people talking about a bad joke that comedian Sarah Silverman made using a different slur. She used the word chink. So he invited her on the show, some other people, an activist, comedian David Spade was on the show, and actress Anne Marie Johnson. Some of you might remember Anne Marie from In Living Color. She's been in a lot of things. So Anne Marie, who's super light-skinned but very Black, was on the show. And there is a 2-minute long rant where Bill says the N-word over and over and over again, because he says, what's the big deal? Every African-American person uses the word day and night. It's in every song. It's been co-opted and it's a term of endearment. And Anne Marie is like, no, that is not the case. Not every African-American uses it. He interrupts her to say, I wouldn't even know you were Black if you didn't tell me.
Wow. Wow. And, you know, so this is the dude that dates almost exclusively
black women,
Bill Maher. And so once again, we have a perfect example of racism from a person who feels like because they are romantically attracted to black people, it excludes them and makes them not racist. Right. Bill Maher is liberal racism 101.
HBO only responded with they will have it removed from the any further airings of the show. Chance the Rapper was like, y'all need to take the show off the air, period. Why does he get to keep his job?
I don't think there are going to be any repercussions for either of them. And here's why. Because racism is associated with badness or goodness, right? So the idea is that racist things can only come from bad intentions and bad people. And there's this sense that Bill Maher is not one of those people because he supports Democrats and he said a couple, you know, slightly progressive things. So his Islamophobia has been forgiven as well as his...
By the mainstream. It hasn't been forgiven by the actual progressives.
Right. Right. It's definitely been forgiven by his network as well. And there are black people that are close to him that get regular slots on his show when they have something to promote and stuff like that. Michael Eric Dyson is one of them. Killer Mike is another one of them. And they're very slow to call him out for that. I mean, Michael Eric Dyson, even when, I mean, I hate it when white people do something wrong and black people start talking about how close they are with somebody. I don't give a shit. Like, that's what we're talking about. Like, does he have black friends? Like, what are you talking about, Michael Eric Dyson? You know? Oh, my heart is hurting because I like this person so much and they so nice and they gave me tea instead of coffee when I needed it. And I hate that. And Killer Mike is a broken record. You know, like you say, oh my God, the environment, you know, pollution is killing us. He's like, well, are you invested in a black bank? Right? Like, I mean, Killer Mike is like a one track.
That's Killer Mike, yeah.
Right. Like, he has nothing else to say and nothing else to give to the debate. And I also hate it when black people say, well, I personally, you know, Jane Doe am not offended. I don't give a shit about you personally. You know, this is a larger issue than you.
Right.
You know that not everybody is Bill Maher's boy. Like, are you saying right now? White people should out here saying that? Like, Killer Mike, with this, he kind of lost me a lot. I don't dispose of people, black people, but yeah, I'm not really there for what Killer Mike is saying on this or Michael Eric Dyson. Michael Eric Dyson tried to double back around, but of course, you know, he has a lot of, you know, 25 cent words. And, you know, he knows how to gloss things over. Killer Mike just had to Twitter. I don't think there are going to be any real repercussions for Bill Maher on this. If there were no repercussions for his Islamophobia, I don't think there are going to be any repercussions for this, especially since he gave his, like, half-assed apology talking about he didn't sleep well the night before or some shit. Friday nights are not my good night. You know? I don't do all the cocaine I should be doing. And I don't know what he was saying, but essentially he was like, yeah, I often bomb on this night and it's just crazy. So yeah, I'm not here. Nobody watches this show. I mean, like, nobody I know. And I don't like it. He's not funny. He's never been funny. He's the quintessential liberal racist. That's what's up.
In our second segment, you mentioned the word disposability. It was like a premonition. Mm-hmm. You knew what we were going to talk about. How did you know?
I never know. I never know what we're talking about. All right.
A person named Janaya Khan, who was the founder of the Black Lives Matter Toronto chapter, wrote a blog post on Medium titled Abolition Culture, Moving Beyond Disposability in the Movement. And I think it's a really interesting topic. We've talked about it briefly when a sexual assault case came up in Black Youth Project 100. Haven't been able to follow up on that transformative process. It would be interesting to know how they've continued to progress that. But basically, that's what Janaya is talking about. In this article, they talk about, on the one hand, you know, the abuse that they've inflicted and the fallouts that they've had. And on the other hand, how they have also suffered abuse and so forth, and how it's instead of, you know, just having your click like you did when you were a child, you click up, you stay loyal, and somebody diss your friend, moving away from the click environment to how can we call in? How can we have accountability processes to resolve conflict and not lose members of the movement or not break up the movement due to personal issues? Janiyah calls it abolitionist in nature, trying to do that. And what happened, though, was some people who read that article felt like Janiyah was trying to speak from a position of authority without acknowledging the abuse that they've inflicted, which, reading it as a bystander who doesn't have any context for it, that's not what I saw. But after reading some other posts that were very detailed about personal experiences, I can see how that could have been very offensive, especially because they are currently wrapped up in an accountability process that is only slowly moving forward. And it must be said that we even mentioned Janiyah last year because Janiyah stood up at Pride last year. And do you remember? With Black Lives Matter.
Right, right.
So this is someone who does, you know, by the standard definition, have a bit of authority and a bit of power. And with power comes responsibility. So what did you think about the article itself?
I think there were some good takeaways on the article.
What were the good takeaways?
So essentially they talk about having conflicts with people and not being able to resolve them and therefore not talking to those people. And it's really hard to have any level of movement with people that you just refuse to talk to. Mm-hmm. Where if you walk into the room, they walk out or vice versa. And I understand the desire to want to at least get to a place where we can work on a common project or at least acknowledge each other's humanity, make amends in some sort of way, even if the relationship is not fully mended to where it was before, right? That was what I understood. There also was an acknowledgement that because of their background, being a foster kid and all of that, that some of the mechanisms that they've used, not so great. So there was some level of accountability of, okay, I have harmed people. They, you know, they're not naming names.
Right.
I've been harmed, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The person that came out in the wake of this was like, wait, you've harmed me specifically. And I've tried to have a process with you and you've not, you know, that process hasn't gone forward. So for you to come and act like, you know, these are my reflections, you know, come drink from my from my pond of wisdom is really kind of salt on the wound. That's what my understanding of the conflict is. It's really hard being in activist spaces, queer spaces specifically. They have a dynamic. In the sense of people date each other, things don't always work out, as you know. And in the wake of that, sometimes there's this feeling like this person is no longer someone I can trust with anything. So I can't trust them with a protest. I can't trust them to help me out of a bind in the community. I can't trust them in any way. Like, I don't want them to have any kind of contact with me because they're not a safe person for me to be around. I don't have the answer on how to mitigate that. That is the scariest thing for me when people start talking about restorative justice and prison abolitionists. Movements. While in theory, I am down for a world without prisons, our society has been so far removed from real life working models of what it looks like to have a community that can take the place of keeping each one of us individually safe in the face of harm, especially intimate partner violence, especially within a queer couple. I think that that's such that's what scares me the most. I've never seen a community do that well with any kind of constellation of relationship.
My question is, why is it problematic for someone like Janiyah to write what seems like a super basic blog post, right? It's supposedly a 5-minute read. I don't even know if I needed 5 minutes to read it. If it's just a reflection without the context of knowing the things that you know if you continue to follow rabbit holes. And apparently Janiyah was also encouraged to write this post. It wasn't even that they necessarily wanted to on their own initiative. But my question is, can't I reflect on my own blog page where I am in my process without that being a problem?
What has come up in the wake of this from the two persons that have posted publicly on Facebook saying that Janiyah has harmed them is that this rhetoric, this talk, this eloquence and articulation of restorative justice principles is at least in their experience with Janaya, has been sort of a precursor to harm. That's why they took issue with it, because it sounded eerily familiar about like, you know, in domestic violence relationships, a lot of times there's this sort of cycle of abuse and apology and, oh, baby, I'm going to do better. And, you know, and so it sounded very familiar to them, the rhetoric that was used, that Janaya would come into a relationship saying, you know, things have not worked out for me all the time. I haven't always been the best person I could be, but I'm trying to like move towards a path of accountability and blah, 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 blah. So it triggered them. It triggered them to be like, wait a second, but you've been saying this and you said this right before you harmed me. Janaya is a person with some level, at least within us queer activist circles, some level of celebrity. With that celebrity comes some level of power. They have blocked and deleted comments on their Facebook page, and their Facebook page is going to get way more views than the Facebook pages of anybody who's just a regular person in Toronto that may be. And Janaya did talk about it. They wrote on their page, I'm not a public person. I'm not interested in having a public process. And in the wake of everything that went down, I feel like my accusers have a much more public process or have a much more public way of trying to deal with the situation than I do. Please don't judge me for not wanting to like do a point for point on Facebook or on Tumblr or on Medium or whatever.
Right.
About my past relationships.
I agree. I'm the same person.
You the same person?
I do not do Facebook grieving, Facebook spitefulness, Facebook envy. I post very little on Facebook these days because everyone has an opinion and everyone has assumptions. And the more you feed them, the more opinions they have. And I'm not interested in being a part of that. I think the intention behind restorative justice is really good. If that intention is, if the space itself is not being held by people who put in a lot of work, and I'm not talking about community work, I'm talking about work on themselves. If someone like that is not holding the space, and then on top of that, the people involved in the process can't hold space or haven't been putting in the work or aren't ready to face all aspects of the conflict, I don't know that it can really work. Without getting, you know, into my spiritual feelings, I don't know that it could work.
Yeah, I think the name and shame process comes to a place where it's like, what is community? In a sense, what the person has been saying is, look, I tried this inner circle stuff. I tried this, our activist space in Toronto, we've been in each other's houses kind of thing. These people all know me. They all know Janaya. And so I've tried being like doing the call-in thing, of saying, let's come together and work this out. Either you come with people, I come with people, or, you know, as I said, there are not a lot of models. So I'm not really sure what was proposed, but it definitely was a smaller, more private thing than, okay, now I'm writing a point for point Tumblr post about like what went down in this relationship, right? Because now the community is everyone who that would interest.
But let's abstract further. It's not about that particular relationship. It's about like the movement, queer activist circles. What do these circles have to do to resolve conflict in a way that doesn't lead to fallout, that doesn't lead to further cliques, that leads to everyone continuing to be able to work together?
Yeah, I think BYP 100 definitely was a great model for that, in the sense of it seemed like, looking in from the outside at least, that when they had someone who was accused of, was it assault?
Sexual assault.
Like that they just had a mechanism that was quick.
Yeah.
And that's
huge. Transparent.
It was quick and it was transparent and they were real about it. And because that didn't happen, the person who was harmed here was like, look, I need to be my own voice. I need to put this out here because I need to prevent harm from happening again. And this community isn't helping me do that. So that seemed to be the way to go for that person. And I understand what that looks like, because if your community doesn't have a process, then you're going to have all to kind of like get all the tools available to you. You know, when, you know, for me, you know, if someone harmed me, it was, you know, my brothers. Those were my tools. For a lot of people now, it's Tumblr, right? That's their tool, or your Facebook or Twitter or what have you. You know, I'm gonna put some sunlight on this and put my piece out there so that I don't feel culpable in enabling you as a person who has harmed me to now go on to a larger stage, to a larger community, and do more harm. And so if people are in your sphere right now or have been in your sphere and have been harmed, you know, they can understand that that's part of your pattern. That's what you do. And there's nothing checking you in this community that you have built and found. There's nothing checking you from replicating your toxic patterns. So I understand that then the thing that can check you is a Google search, right? Like, because those people will find it now and they're going to know what's up. If you want to build a movement with any kind of movement, activist movement, you want to have a little collective house, you want to have a circle of friends that have romance, whatever it is, there needs to be a mechanism for accountability within that. This lack of a mechanism for accountability has been something that led to the falling apart of a lot of amazing social struggles in the past, right? Because if you were in a Black Panther Party and you were raped, what was the mechanism for accountability? If you were in SNCC, right, and someone was blackmailing you because you were homosexual, what was the mechanism for accountability? Okay, that's hard to admit, because SNCC has done great work, Black Panthers have done great work, and many other organizations have done great work. But we are coming from a toxic society, and we are replicating these interpersonal toxic patterns within these relationships and activist circles. And there needs to be a mechanism to say, okay, not here. We ain't calling the police, but that means that we have to have some way of affecting justice in this space.
And in our final segment, what are we excited about? What are we looking forward to? I'm going to go because you will just tell me to anyway. So a few weeks ago, I might have mentioned a certain Tribeca Film Festival and a certain film about Whitney. Who is going to see that film on Sunday with a Q&A with the director?
Okay, you know.
I am. London wins again. Whitney, can I be me? And the reason I'm excited about this is because, as I mentioned back then, the first time, a lot of this footage is, you know, it's never been surfaced, but not a lot of people were on board with this film. So I'm interested to hear how the director is going to defend or justify that form of working on it. But first, I'm just going to enjoy me some Whitney. Yep, yep. And I just hope that it's a well-rounded film. That's what I'm hoping for, that it doesn't try to push a certain narrative about why she was unhappy or what happened in her life, because we are, you know, multidimensional people. But I am looking forward to seeing some footage of Whitney with her bestie.
Oh, you know that.
I'm very excited. I will say, I haven't seen Wonder Woman yet.
Okay.
I'm still kind of sort of excited about the film. The film did well. It did very well on its first weekend, $223 million. You know, there's been some critique on the different sides. Now, I did read one critique and I just stopped reading it because I was afraid of spoilers. And it was talking about, oh, what this film shows is that white people are happy to let white women continue the imperial blah, blah. And I was just kind of like, as far as I know, Wonder Woman is going on the comic. So if that's going to be the criticism, then you would need to take that back to the comic. Like, there's not, the movie is not going to rewrite the comic.
And then that's every superhero movie, right?
Right. Like, so I don't really know why that was the particular critique. However, I am looking forward to seeing the film. What about you?
Baywatch.
Yes. Oh, I'm going to see Baywatch. That's my boo.
You may not know this, but no, I am.
No. Don't
actually
legally
married.
Don't see. No.
Rock Johnson.
Okay, look.
I have said it. Now the paparazzi gonna come for me. It's been said.
This is why I don't like you.
Secret.
It's full of lies. The Rock has always been my boo. Let me remind you, University of Miami, okay? We go way back.
Oh,
way back.
That's my boo. I told you that, and you know, he's got a whole canon of movies, and there's like, I've seen them all because, you know, Netflix is
you haven't.
But another thing coming up in Vienna is the Danube Island Festival. Like, all the greats are coming through. So that's going to be great. 3 days of, like, walking on that whole island and just experiencing music. It's going to be very, very crowded. You should check that out if you're in Vienna, of course. And Pride is coming. So I'm very excited. We call it our Rainbow Parade. So I'm very excited to see what's going on with Pride in Vienna this year. And I was going to mention Wonder Woman too, but you know, it comes, of course, to London before it comes to Vienna. So what can I do?
Well, that's all for this week. If you'd like to keep up with us, you can follow us on Twitter at The Queer Truth. We'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the things we've discussed today, so feel free to get at us. And if you have a dime or two, drop by patreon.com/queertruth and donate. Until next time, peace out.